Okay. Hari Om to all of you. I see a lot of new faces here, and there's something I must tell you about these Gita classes. Some of the not old students but seasoned students are here. Some have started from chapter 1 and they've stayed on till chapter 18. Very dedicated, very committed. Some students have come in from chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 15. Some even came in towards the end, chapter 17. Some other students came and suddenly disappeared. I have not seen them for a few years. So, the progress, many people ask, how long will it take me to realize or know this Gita knowledge? It all depends upon you, how much of effort you put in. The study of the Gita is not something that is to be taken lightly. And the way these classes are structured is that not just to give you information, it is not just to help you to memorize Gita slokas so that you can impress your friends and relatives and quote from the Gita left and right. That information has to be given to you is only knowledge, but it must result in transformation. So information that leads to transformation. What is that transformation? Transformation means how you deal with the world. This knowledge must be applicable to help you to deal with the world. And when we say world, we are talking about three components. That is people or individuals that we interact with, be it in your house, your family, or at your workplace, or your society or community. The second is objects. How do we relate to the objects? That means the material objects that we have. And the third is what we call situations in life. You encounter all types of situations. So POS, people, object, situation. So these classes are structured for you to take this knowledge, learn how to convert it and apply it in your daily life. Otherwise, this knowledge is a waste of time for you. Now, having said that, these classes are only once a week. So you come on a Thursday, 7:30 to 8:45. Once you leave from here, then what do you do? So if you are not going to spend time daily, and I really mean it seriously, daily, whether it is 15 minutes or 30 minutes or 1 hour, whatever you think you can set aside, but daily reflecting and reading, you are not going to benefit. Because just by coming once a week and hearing the lectures and then you come next week, I can tell you, you'll forget everything you heard last week. So it is very important that if you want to know this Gita knowledge, you want to learn how to apply it in your life, not only attend these lectures and take notes, but do your own study, do your own daily reading. It is going to help not me, it is going to help you in life. And you can speak to the other students who have been coming for so many years, how they have changed, how they have benefited from this knowledge. And this is the feedback I've received, so which I'm sharing with you. Okay? So now let us move on. You can bring any Gita you want. The Bhagavad Gita Ashram has their own Gitas, but you don't have to buy this. We sell this at 15 ringgit a copy. You can bring any Gita you have. I will mention the verse and the chapter that we are referring to, so you can refer to your own Gitas. That's not necessary that you have to get the Gitas. Those who want to borrow, there are also additional copies at the altar here. Okay. Now, before we embark on the knowledge of the Gita, first of all, the question is always asked that there are so many scriptures in Hinduism, is there not? Now, yeah, one more thing. Please feel free to stop and ask me any questions, anything you don't understand. This is a very interactive class. So I'll throw questions at you, try to answer whatever the best you can, and you can also ask me questions. So, question is always asked, why do we need to study the Gita? In Hinduism, we have so many scriptures. There are the Vedas, there are the Upanishads, there are the Puranas, there are the Itihasas. What is the importance of the Gita in relation to all the scriptures, and where does the Gita fit into all this? So for that, first of all, let us take a very broad look at the type of scriptures that we have available to us. Okay? So, what is the oldest scripture that we have available? Anybody? The Vedas. Okay, how many Vedas are there? Four Vedas. What are the four Vedas? Rig Veda, Sam Veda, Atharva Veda, and Yajur Veda. Correct. So, the Vedas are four, as we all know. The Vedas contain thousands of verses, and the Vedas fall under this group of scriptures which is called Srutis. Now, why are they called Srutis? Because it comes from the root word Srunu, means they were heard. So, there is no particular author of the Vedas. The Vedas have taken a period of thousands of years. They are divine revelations which were communicated by God to men. So that's why they are called Srutis. Okay, so Srutis. And each of the four Vedas is in turn partitioned in four sections. So what are the four sections? If we go back to the very early dawn of civilization, we must understand that the Vedas go back thousands and thousands of years. The early man did not know anything about God, right? His only interest was how to survive in this new world. So, yet this early man looked around in his environment and he saw all the elements like rain, wind, sun, moon, etc., fire, and he received divine revelations that all these individual elements that he saw, he started singing praises of all these elements. So, the early part of the Vedas, the first part of the Vedas, all the four Vedas, the early part is called the Samhitas. What are Samhitas? Samhitas are hymns in praise of various elements. So, you have a hymn in praise of Agni Devata, fire Devata. You have hymns in praise of sun, Surya Devata. Wind, Vayu Devata. So they just praise all the elements. Because these elements gave them life. These elements help to fertilize the crops. Basically, they depended on these elements for their very survival. So they sang praises of the various elements. And these are all hymns which are recorded in the four Vedas under the section called Samhitas. Okay. Now, when you sing praises of somebody, what is the next thing you want to do? When you sing praises, you love, you like somebody, you sing praises of them. I'm sure you sing praises of your husband and wife. What do you like to do next? Offer some gifts to them, isn't it? So, as man progressed and he started singing hymns to all these various devatas, he wanted to offer something. So came the second section of the Vedas, which is called Brahmanas. So what a Brahmana section? The Brahmana section is, it required a Brahmin priest, and the Brahmin priest came out with elaborate rituals and prayers that required mantras to be chanted, that required offerings to be made, flowers, leaves, etc., fruit, etc. So first came the chanting, then came elaborate rituals. Required a Brahmin priest, required materials to be given, required mantras to be chanted. And this is a very important part of the development of our religion, because even the Bhagavad Gita is divided in the same way. I will explain. In the initial part of our life, all of us, how did we start on our religion? How did we start on our Hindu religion? Saying prayers, going to temples, right? Offering prayers to God and asking for things, right? You want success in marriage, you want happiness in your family, you want success in business. There are various types of rituals and prayers. You go into a new house, you do a Havan Yajna to invoke the gods to bless your house. So So this is exactly what the Brahmanas were. The Brahmanas were rituals and prayers which are in the Vedas. Whatever you seek in life, there are various prayers that you can do these prayers and seek the blessings of the various gods. Because the saints also recognize that not everybody is ready for knowledge, isn't it? In the early part of life, we have different priorities. We have our family, we have elderly parents to look after, we want to study, we want to get a good job. So initially, we start with mostly rituals and prayers. So this is also how our scriptures also progress. Now, so from hymns, it progressed to prayers and rituals. Then came the third stage of development. When the early men grow old, retire to forests. In the forest, this early man did a little bit of rituals, but because he was in the forest, he had some time for contemplation. So the third part of the Vedas are called Aranyakas. Aranyakas comes from the root word Aranya, which means forest. So as people retired to a quiet life, they did minimum rituals and did some amount of contemplation. Again, all these were divine revelations that were being sent by God to selected individuals. Even sages and saints are mentioned in the Vedas. Yajnavalkya, Vashishta, and all these are mentioned there. Okay, so these are called forest treaties, or partly rituals, partly what we call contemplation. Okay. Then came the final part of the Vedas, which are called the Upanishads. Okay, and this is the most important part here, because all this here, the Samhitas, the Brahmanas, the Aranyakas, deal more with what we call the Karma Kanda. They are called the Karma Kanda. Together, these three portions are called the Karma Kanda, meaning they deal mainly with prayers, rituals, and things that you are seeking from the gods. So various things that we want, various joys or material things that we want, are all contained in these three sections, and they are called the Karma Kanda. But Upanishads are called the Jnana Kanda. Karma means action, Jnana means knowledge. This section of the Upanishads, and what is the meaning of Upanishads? Does anybody know? What is the meaning of Upanishad? You have heard this name before, I'm sure, Upanishad. But what is the meaning of Upanishad? No. What is the meaning of Upanishad? Upanishad means, it comes from three words, Upa, Ni, Shad. It means sitting, down, near. Meaning, it was a student sitting at the feet of his master, and the master gave him knowledge. And what knowledge was this? Not knowledge about prayers or rituals or what we call all kinds of mantras and all that. These Upanishads dealt with only one subject, and that is what we call Brahman. Brahman means the highest, what we call the highest aspect of God, which is attributeless, without any attributes. So it was a student who went to the teacher, surrendered to the teacher and said, I want to know Brahman. Okay? The teacher in Upanishads never went knocking on people's door. Okay? It was a student who surrendered to the teacher and wanted knowledge, because the student had reached a level where there was thirst for knowledge, to know about God. So, these Upanishads are also called Vedanta. They are also known as Vedanta. Why they are known as Vedanta? Because they come from two words, Vedanta. You see that there are two words, Veda, Anta. Anta means end. Veda means the four Vedas. They come at the end portion of the Vedas. So just like I told you, in the beginning, people are not interested in knowledge because they have other priorities in life. So first of all, you make sure that they have all the basic material requirements that they want. Whatever family they want, success in business they want, success in studies, everything is here. When they have satisfied their material needs, then only they come to the highest knowledge of Brahman. Now, the four Vedas contains thousands and thousands of verses. And how many Upanishads are there? Does anybody know how many Upanishads are there? Huh? 108 Upanishads. There were many, many Upanishads, but many have been lost throughout time. Right now, there exists 108 Upanishads, and the list of all these 108 Upanishads is given in one of the Upanishads called the Muktika Upanishad. One of the Upanishads, which is called Muktika Upanishad, gives a list of all these 108 Upanishads. And they contain a very high, profound knowledge about Brahman. Now, who is the author of the Vedas? Who is the author of the Vedas? You heard the name Vedavyasa. Okay? But Vedavyasa is not the author of the Vedas. He is the one who compiled all the various sayings, the srutis of the various sages and saints, and he partitioned it into the four Vedas, and he in turn partitioned it into the four sections also. So Vedavyasa is the partitioner of the Vedas. And you must remember another thing, in the early ages there were no written materials. Like now you have iPad and all paper and pen to write. In those days, when they received the divine revelations, they memorized it and they passed it on to others. So it was kept alive by memory. So what Vedavyasa did, and we owe him a very big favor, he collected all the sayings and put it down into writing, into the four Vedas. So this is the Vedas now, the four Vedas, which give us the rituals and the knowledge. So there's two, there's karma and there's jnana. The Bhagavad Gita also is divided in the same way also. Okay, any questions so far? Am I going too fast, too slow? Okay, no problem. Anything you don't understand, please raise your hand and ask a question. Okay, so this is the Vedas. Now, apart from the Vedas, we also have another group of scriptures which are called the Puranas. Now, how many Puranas are there? 18 Puranas. There are 18 Puranas. Now, what is the purpose of the Puranas? Vedas gave us the rituals, Vedas gave us the knowledge. So, what is the purpose of the 18 Puranas? Stories. Puranas are stories. So, what is the purpose of telling a story? Huh?
Easier to comprehend.
The problem is, what is the biggest problem?
Convey a message.
Sorry?
Convey a message.
So what is the problem? They're conveying a message, that's correct. What is the problem? The problem is, people remember the story and forget the message. Right? So you will find a lot of bombastic stories in the Puranas, right? Many, many stories you all might have heard, fantastic bombastic stories, okay? Example, there's a very famous story about Ganesha and Murugan, is it? Murugan, who was challenged for to be given the special mango, said who can go around the world three times, you get this special mango. So what did Murugan do? He jumped on the peacock. And he went around the actual world. What did Ganesha do? Made his parents sit down and went around three times. And he got the mango. And people say, what a story. What are we supposed to learn from this? Can you actually go around the world three times on the peacock? See, story is very bombastic, right? Doesn't sound very,
realistic.
But what is the purpose of the story, as you rightly say, to attract your attention? You remember the story, but you forget the lesson. What is the lesson? Parents are the world. Exactly. That's what, if you remember, when you went to school, you were told about Aesop's fables. You remember? One of the very interesting fables was, you go to forest and there's this turtle who is challenged to a race by a rabbit. You know, there's no rabbit and turtle challenging each other in the forest, isn't it? So the story was to attract you, to attract your attention. What is the moral of the story? Slow and steady wins the race. So similarly, Puranas are like that. And the Puranas are also, each Purana does highlight one of the various gods. So you have Shiv Purana, you have Ganesh Purana. Which is the Purana for Lord Krishna? Srimad Bhagavatam. Don't mix up Bhagavatam with Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavatam is a Purana. How many verses does Srimad Bhagavatam contain? How many verses? Take a guess. 18,000 verses. Okay, the Srimad Bhagavatam contains 18,000 verses. Some of the small Puranas contain about 9,000 verses. Okay, there are few short Puranas that contain, those are the shortest Puranas that contain 9,000 verses. Do you know which is the longest Purana? Skanda Purana. S.K. Skanda, the son of Shiva. Skanda Purana contains 81,000 verses. Okay, so shortest Purana 9,000, longest Purana 81,000. And this is where the confusion comes, because somebody who is a Shiva devotee reads the Shiva Purana and he says what? Shiva is God, the rest are all secondary. Somebody reads the Srimad Bhagavatam says Krishna is God, then that person believes Srimad Bhagavatam, he says all the others are secondary. But in reality, actually all are the same, from the same source. So there is no need to quarrel about who is the more superior God and inferior God. There is no superior inferior. There is only one God, which is called Brahman, which manifests in different forms. These stories are for a devotee to get close to the Ishta Devata. If I have love for Ganesha, if I have love for Shiva, if I have love for Krishna, then I read the relevant Purana. In the Purana, all the pastimes of these Devas are told, all their various stories, where they grow up, all the kinds of stories, what they went through. So this is to attract us more closer. But the purpose of the Puranas is to teach us a lesson that comes from the Vedas. So those people who don't want to, who are not inclined to read so much of verses from the Vedas, what you do is you read the Purana stories, enjoy the stories, but learn the lesson. Okay? So now we have the Puranas. Okay. Then that is still not enough. Yes.
The Brahman you mentioned.
Right.
It's the same as Brahma.
Okay. Very good question. Just now I mentioned was Brahman, which is what? The knowledge the Upanishads give us. We must be very careful not to mix this up with Brahma, Vishnu and Shiva or Mahesha, which is, see, Brahman is what we call unmanifest. It has no attributes. Okay? Whereas all these have some form, some shape, some attributes. Right? So, the highest is Brahman. This is what the Upanishads are talking about, Brahman. And sometimes we also use the word Atman, which is one and the same. Okay? So Atman and Brahman is one and the same. It is like saying, what is the difference with Atman and Brahman? Why two names? Think about Brahman as a total space or air. Now, if I take a bottle and I close the bottle, there is air inside the bottle, isn't it? What is the difference with the air inside the bottle and the air outside the bottle? Is there a difference? Are you sure? There's no difference. Right. So, air inside the bottle, air outside the bottle is same. But what we say, air inside the bottle and air outside the bottle, we give it two different names. That's the difference between Atman, which is in us, and Brahman, which is all-pervading. Same, Parabrahman, same. You say Parabrahman, right? Just different names we give, Parabrahman. When we say Ishvara, here we are talking about with attributes. Brahman is without attributes. Ishvara is when that Brahman has attributes, right? So, all the while here we are going to talk about Bhagavad Gita, we are referring to Brahman, okay? Okay, so now we have the Puranas, and that's still not enough. No, we like to confuse Hinduism a lot, so give you a lot of scriptures to study. Whole life you can go on studying scriptures. Vedas, thousands of verses, Puranas, 18 Puranas, 81,000 verses, 9,000 verses, whole life you cannot finish, but still not enough. We have a third group of scriptures, which is called Itihasas. Does anybody know what the word Itihasas means? Not epics. There's another meaning for Itihasas. Itihasa means history, or so it happened. That means it really happened. So, which are the Itihasas? Ramayana. Ramayana, very good. So, there are two Itihasas. One is Ramayana and one is Mahabharata. Now, who is the author of Ramayana? Valmiki. Valmiki is the author of Ramayana. In fact, there was one time I was taking a class somewhere else, and there used to be this mother used to come with a very young girl, about 8-9 years old. And she used to make the girl sit down there, and this girl, she used to bring her coloring books and all the while she'd be coloring. As I'm talking, she's busy coloring her books. Mother and all are listening to the Gita lecture. So I don't know whether she was really listening, but all the while I see her busy with the coloring books. So one day I just asked this question. Who is Valmiki? And this 8-year-old girl puts up a hand. I was very happy. I said, oh, very good. At least she's listening. So I said, yes, you know who is Valmiki? She said, yes, yes, I know. Who is Valmiki? She said, creator of Mickey Mouse. Never mind, go back to your coloring. So, Valmiki is the author of Ramayana. But we also told that Tulsidas also wrote a Ramayana, which is a different Ramayana approached from a different angle. But the original writer of the Ramayana is Valmiki. Do you know what was Valmiki's original name? Valmiki was not Valmiki. He had another name. He was a robber. So he had another name. His name was Ratnakara. Okay? So the story goes that Ratnakar was a very famous robber. He used to go and rob people on the highways. And one day he saw a group of pilgrims, sadhus. And they were singing and dancing and so happy. And he said, let me rob them because they look very happy, they must be very rich. So he went to take a knife and rob them. He told the sadhus, give me all your money. The sadhus started laughing. He said, you're mad. We are sadhus. We hardly got 1-2 rupees in our pocket. What are you trying to rob us of that also? He said, cannot be, you look so happy, only rich people look happy, so you must be having money. He said, no, we don't have, you can check. So he checked, they had only 1-2 rupees. One of the sadhus happened to be Narad. So Narad saw Ratnakar. He said, you look like from somebody from a very good family. Why are you doing all this, you know, stealing and robbing? Don't you realize the amount of sins you are creating? So, and he asked the robber, why are you doing all this? So Ratnakar said, you know, I got aged parents, I got old father and mother to look after, I got a wife, I got kids, so I got no other means, I go and rob and get money to support my family. But Narada told him, since you are creating for your family, But when you die, who is going to suffer in hell? Only you. Do you think your family will help you to suffer your sins? You say, yes, of course. They will also join me and suffer in my sin. You say, you go and ask them. So he tied up Narad and he went back to his family and he called his family and he said, I've been creating so many sins by robbing people, hurting people, just for you only, for my family I've been doing it. And because of you all, I'm going to hell. So would you all also follow me to hell and share my sins? They said, you can go to hell, we don't care. Why should we suffer for your sins? You did it, we didn't do it. So Pradnaka realized that he has been doing a lot of wrong things. So he goes back to Narad, apologizes to him, and then he starts finding out more and more. He asks Narad to tell him about an example of a perfect human being. So Narad tells him about Lord Rama, and Valmiki writes the whole story about Lord Rama. So that's one of the itihasas. How many verses does the Ramayana contain? 24,000 verses. Okay, 24,000 verses. Yes. Well, basically he got it from Valmiki. Narad. And he also went and to find out more and more about Lord Rama because he wanted to have a perfect example of a human being that he could follow. So thus he took. So when he sat down and meditated on this Lord Rama, an actual anthill form around him. He sat down and meditated and lost all his time. He didn't know what he was doing. So an anthill built around him. So came the name Valmiki, which means anthill. Okay. So that is Ramayana. Now we come to the another itihasa called Mahabharata. Mahabharata, I'm sure most of you know, it is a story about the Kauravas and the Pandavas, the evil Kauravas and the good Pandavas. How many verses does the Mahabharata contain? 100,000 verses. Okay. So these are all the scriptures now. We have the Vedas, thousands of verses. We have 18 Puranas, thousands of verses. We have Ramayana, 24,000 verses. Mahabharata, 100,000 verses. Where does the Gita fit into all this now? It is embedded in the Mahabharata in the section which is called Bhishma Parva. Parva means chapter. Bhishma is the name of the chapter. And in the chapters 25 to 42, these 18 chapters are separately called Bhagavad Gita. Why? Because in these 18 chapters contains the very important dialogue between Lord Krishna and Arjuna, between God and man. So these 18 chapters separately are called the Bhagavad Gita. It is an extract of the Mahabharata. Now, you can see the problem when you start to study the Bhagavad Gita. Now, if you open to your Gita books, chapter 1, verse 1, okay, you will see this. What is the major problem facing us? So the first chapter, chapter 1, verse 1, goes as this. Dhritarashtra Vacha. Dharma Chetre Kuru Chetre Samaveta Yuyutsava Mamaka Pandavas Chaiva Kim Akurvata Sanjaya. Here is Dhritarashtra asking Sanjaya, assemble on this battlefield my sons and the sons of Pandu desiring to fight, what did they do? So do you see one big problem here? What is the big problem? One is battlefield. What else? There's this character called Dhritarashtra. There's this character called Sanjaya. There's some fighting about to start. But what do you come to study? What do you want to know? Why the fighting? Why do you want to know your religion? Why do you want to know about your religion? So one is to rectify ourselves, one is to know about God and how should I change myself to be a better human being and to how to progress on the spiritual path. But instead, when we open the Gita book, what greets us? Some fighting going on, some war going on. And this is exactly, I am telling you why, because it was my problem 30 years ago. When I had no knowledge of the Gita, there was a Gita book lying in my house. I took it up out of some curiosity, I don't know why. I opened a book because I wanted to know about God. I wanted to know how to improve myself as a human being. And then I see this Dhritarashtra, I don't know who Dhritarashtra, talking to Sanjaya about some war. And I say, what is this book of nonsense? It doesn't make any sense to me. I want to know about God. I want to know about religion. I want to know how to be a better person. But this book is not the answer. I kept it back. 6 months later, out of curiosity, again I took it. I opened it. I still couldn't understand. I was fortunate then when somebody told me that in Gita Ashram, every Sunday they are having discourses on the Gita in English, where they go through 7 verses every Sunday. And that's when I started coming, started understanding little by little by little by little. So, why I tell you this is because it is also important for us to understand 3 things before we embark on the study of the Gita. First, we should have a little bit, some overall understanding about the Mahabharata. Not totally. I'm not going to tell you all the 100,000 verses. You'll be here for the next 10 years. Second, Arjuna had a problem on the battlefield in Kurukshetra. Right? The first chapter is called Arjuna Vishada Yoga. Arjuna fell into a state of despondency or depression. The question is asked, why should I care about Arjuna's problem? When did the battlefield in Kurukshetra happen? 5,000 years ago, right? Today, 5,000 years later, how can I relate my problem and Arjuna's problem? His problem was different. He had a problem on the battlefield. I am not on the battlefield. I am not a soldier. How do I relate to Arjuna's problem? If we can't understand Arjuna's problem, then how are we going to appreciate the Gita? So, second, we must understand how does Arjuna's problem relate to us. And the third is, why did was the battlefield chosen as the place where Krishna delivered the message of the Gita? So for that, let us first of all look at the short overall view of the Mahabharata. Okay? Now, many of you might know this, but I'm just going through in case those of you who do not know, at least when we come to the first verse, we are very clear. So chapter 1 is how Arjuna fell into despondency. So what is chapters 2 to 18? Huh? How we overcome the state of despondency. So Arjuna, the patient, fell into state of despondency, chapter 1. How Dr. Krishna gives the remedy in chapter 2 to 18. So first we must understand what is the problem of Arjuna. So let us look at first, very briefly, at the Mahabharata. Now, basically the Mahabharata, we have the king called Santanu. Santanu married the daughter of a fisherman called Satyavati. Okay? But before he could marry Satyavati, the fisherman's daughter, the fisherman had some conditions for him. What are the conditions? Fisherman was a very smart person. That the child born to Satyavati should be made the king of the palace. Why? Because Santanu had an earlier son by another wife, and the son was called Devarata. Okay? So the fisherman didn't want Devarata to be the king. He said, if you marry my daughter, make sure that her offspring becomes the king. Of course, Santanu could not give this promise because he said, how can I deprive my eldest son of the throne of Hastinapura? The kingdom was called Hastinapura. Nowadays, it is called Delhi. Okay. So now, what happened is, Devarata found out about this. He went to see the father and he gave the father a promise that he will not have any stake on the kingdom. And Devarata was a man of his word. The fisherman father knew that if Devarata said he won't have any interest in the kingdom, he will do so. But the father was not happy still. He wanted one more promise. What was the promise? He said, okay, I trust you. You won't take the throne. What happens if you get married and your children want to take the throne? Then what will happen to my daughter's children? So Jayavrata gave a second promise to the father. He said, I will remain a celibate for the rest of my life. I will not marry. Now, such a vow taken by a young man to give up the throne and give up even the rights to marriage. So the heavens and the gods, and why? Because of the love for his father, he was willing to sacrifice. So the gods blessed Devarata and he took the new name called Vishwamitra. Out of respect, you call him Vishwamitra. Now, Santanu married Satyavati and they had two sons by the name of somebody. Got to help me, I also cannot remember. And okay, Vichitavirya and Chitranga. So these two fellows married two princes called Amba and Ambalika. Okay. So anyway, they married these two princes. Everything was okay. But unfortunately, they died. And King Santanu also died. Now, Satyavati had a big problem. What's the problem now? No offspring. How to carry on the kingdom? So she went to Bhishma Pita. She said, you marry these two princes and you produce offspring. He said, I have given a vow to your father that I will remain a celibate. I will never break that vow. So nothing doing. So what did she do? She was desperate. She went to sage Vyasa. And she told him, you produced the offspring from these two princes. Now we must understand one thing. Sage Vyasa was a very highly realized sage. So when he passed on his way of conception, it is not the normal way, but they had the powers to pass on that conception to the ladies. So first, one of the princes was called to go and see Vyasa. And Vyasa had a very horrible looking face. He was very unkempt, very dirty, because he was a sadhu wandering around. So he got the orders from the queen now to produce an offspring. So when one of the princes went, she got such a shock on seeing him that she closed the eyes, and thus the first prince was born called Dhritarashtra, who was born blind. So the second princess was now warned, if you go and see Vyasa now, make sure you keep your eyes open. Whatever you do, don't close your eyes. So she went, she kept eyes open, but when he came, she couldn't stand the shock. So she became very pale and very scared. So the second son was born to the prince was called Pandu, and he was born very sickly and very weak. Now the princess said, let me try third time. So she went to see one of the maid servants was working in the palace. So maid servants, they've seen all the hardships of life, nothing very things that they cannot handle. So she said, you go and see the Ved Vyasa. So she went and he also passed on his powers and she produced the third child, which is called Vidhu. So now you have Dhritarashtra, who is blind, Pandu, who is weak and sickly, and you have Vidhur, who is produced from a maid servant. So obviously now Dhritarashtra cannot rule because he is blind. Vidhur also cannot rule because born from a maid servant. So Pandu took over the kingdom. Okay. Pandu married two wives. Okay. One wife was called Kunti and the other was called Madhuri. So Kunti produced him how many children? Three children, which are Yudhishthira, Bhima and Arjuna. Okay. Most important for us to remember now this character called Arjuna, because he is the one who is going to have the dialogue with Lord Krishna. Okay? And Madhuri produced for him Nakula and Sahadeva. Very good. These are twins. Here Dhritarashtra married Gandhari,
And if you see the Mahabharata serial, you will see this lady, she has the white strap around the eyes because she wanted to experience the blindness that her husband was experiencing. And how many children did she give him?
100 sons
and one daughter. Don't ask me to give all the names. But important to remember is the elder son's name, which is Duryodhana. Very important character. Okay. Now, Pandu passed away. Therefore, who should rule the kingdom? Yudhishthira. But the Dhritarashtra's children, which are called the Kauravas, and Pandu's dynasty is called Pandavas. These Kauravas were not at all happy that the Pandavas were ruling the kingdom. So they tried all ways and means to throw them out of the kingdom by trying to burn them in a house. They got them in a house and tried to burn the whole house down. They also tried to poison Bhima. They also tried to, finally they involved the Pandavas in a game of dice and they cheated them, and the rule of the dice game was that if whoever lost the dice game had to go into exile for 12 years plus one more year incognito. I mean, nobody must recognize. If you are recognized, you start again in the 12 years. So they cheated the Pandavas in a game of dice. The Pandavas lost the game of dice and they went into the forest for 12 years. Plus 130. The agreement was when the Pandavas came back, the kingdom will be given back to them. Okay? So the Pandavas went 13 years in exile, came back, and they asked Duryodhana, now give us back our kingdom. We kept our part of the promise, now you keep your part of the promise. He said, no dice. I will not give you back your kingdom. They said, okay, give us 5 cities. 5 brothers are there. Give us 1 city each. He said, no dice. Okay, give us 5 villages. No, nothing doing. Okay, give us 5 houses. Also nothing doing. He said, that much of sand, that much of earth, which I can put on the hoof of a cow, that much also I won't give you back. So therefore, the Pandavas had no choice but to come to the battlefield and this big battle of Mahabharata. So now, if we come to this chapter 1, verse 1, and if you read now, knowing this background, now we can understand why this Dhritarashtra is saying this. But one question, if you look at the last line here, what did they do? So we must understand now. Now the battle has started. Sanjaya is Dhritarashtra's charioteer. So he goes to the battlefield. Where is the battlefield? Kurukshetra, which is 100 kilometers north of Delhi. There is a town there right now called Panipat. If you go there, you would see a lot of museums and temples which were created there to indicate where this whole big battle of Mahabharata happened. Okay, it is there now. All the relics are there. So Sanjaya went to the battlefield. On the 10th day of battle, something terrible happened. What was that? Bhishma Pita was shot by arrows by Arjuna and he fell to the ground. He did not die. But it was a very shocking thing to the Kauravas because they never expected Bhishma Pita to fall. So Sanjaya rushed back to Hastinapura to inform the blind king that Bhishma Pita has now fallen. And then Bhishma Pita now tells him, hey Sanjaya, Dharma Kshetre Kuru Kshetre, on the land, Kshetra means land. This land where the Pandavas and Kauravas were assembled to fight was called Dharma Kshetre because it was a very pious piece of land. A lot of sadhus, saints had gone there and done many prayers and rituals. So it was a very positive charged part of land. And whenever anything where there is dharma, that means the outcome will be for the good people. So it was Dharma Kshetre. Also another thing interesting to note, many times people ask me, you know, Bhagavad Gita is how many verses? 700 verses, 18 chapters. But many people don't have patience to learn the Bhagavad Gita. So they ask me, can you tell me the Gita in 1 minute flat? Can you tell me the Gita in 1 minute flat? Because I don't have time to go through 700 verses. So I tell them, take the first word of the Gita, which is Dharma, and the last word of the Gita, which is Mama. Dharma, Mama means what?
My Dharma.
my dharma. So what is the Gita trying to tell us? What is your dharma? As a dharma is what? As what? Duty is what? Yeah, right conduct as what? As a human being, isn't it? We know we have taken incarnations, life after life after life, through the animal, through the plant, through the animal incarnation, to the human incarnation. The human incarnation is the pinnacle of God's creation. Why? Why is the human incarnation the most superior of all because of the intellect, the buddhi, that is not available to animals, that is not available to plants. What is the intellect for? Discrimination, to choose between what is right, between what is wrong. So a human being can decide whether I want to be a vegetarian or I want to be a non-vegetarian, whether I want to be an alcoholic, whether I want to be a non-alcoholic, isn't it? Whether I want to come to Gita Ashram or go to Sanvi Pyramid for shopping. You can decide. But that is not available to animals and to plants. So that discriminatory quality is not there. So dharma mama means, how can I use this intellect with this human form that I've been given to guide my life and reach my destination? Right? That is called dharma mama. That means, what is the Gita teaching us? How to live our life. Unfortunately, many people take up the knowledge of the Gita when? Towards the end of the life. They say, when I retire, when I have nothing to do, then I'll read the Gita. The Gita is not a book that teaches you how to die. It teaches you how to live your life. Right? So, when we take this knowledge, you must know, gain this knowledge and how to live. So, that is how the Mahabharata is connected to the first few verses. Now, second very important thing. Many people ask, what is Arjuna's problem got to do with me? Arjuna had the problem on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Why should it have any connection to do with me? His problem is different, my problems are different. But if we analyze Arjuna's problem, the symptoms of Arjuna's problem are exactly the symptoms that mankind has been going through for thousands of years, is going through now, and will continue to suffer unless you get the knowledge of the Gita. So, what is Arjuna's problem? The first problem that Arjuna faced, he faced three symptoms which we are all facing. The first symptom that Arjuna faced was what we call as raga or attachment. Now, many people also mistake raga, attachment, as love. What is the difference between attachment and love? You know, sometimes they come for Gita class, we say mustn't have attachment. Doesn't mean that you are so serious, don't want to love anybody. I'm a jnani, I'm now a Gita devotee, so I mustn't love anybody. No. There is a difference between attachment and love. What is the difference? What is the difference between attachment and love? What's the word? Expectations. The difference is, attachment is when we have expectations. There is an emotional attachment. So we have expectations. And when those expectations are not met, when your spouse doesn't behave the way you want him to behave, when your child doesn't behave the way you want them to behave, what happens? Huh? You feel frustrated, you feel defeated, you feel dejected. Whereas love is unconditional. It is not dependent. So to love is not a problem. But to be emotionally dependent, that is what we call attachment. Now, who was Arjuna attached to? Bhishma Pita, Dronacharya, so many beloved relations of him, of his, were on the Kaurava side, whom he had to meet in battle, whom he had to kill. Now, so attachment causes this problem. It is based on selfishness. As long as you behave the way I want, I love you, which is actually attachment. Secondly, also, attachment comes from a weak mind. Why we say weak mind? Because I don't have happiness, my happiness is dependent upon what? Upon a particular person. Or if I only have this car, I only have this handphone, then I'll be happy. So where is your happiness dependent upon now? On an external object. And what is the nature of people, objects and situations?
Transitory
and changing. What type of happiness do you want? Permanent happiness. Where do you depend your permanent happiness on? Most of us, where do they depend happiness on? Outside, which is changing, which is transitory. So how can your happiness not be changing? When everybody wants 24/7 happiness, but depends that happiness on the transitory world, obviously your happiness will go through ups and downs. So, attachment Arjuna had to all his relatives, but attachment did not create a problem until when? When does attachment create a problem? So you say, okay, so what if I'm attached to my family, I'm attached to my husband, my wife, my relatives, my in-laws, outlaws, everything, I'm attached, so what? But when does it create a problem? Huh? When expectations are not met, somehow what else? When you? Where did Arjuna's problem come? He had attachment. Prior to that, he had no problem. When did his problem start? When he had to kill them, means what? So that means, when does your attachment create a problem? When you are faced with the possibility of losing what you are attached to. Isn't it? I'm sitting in this seat or position of power. I'm attached to this position of power. I got no problem. The minute somebody comes to challenge me and try to throw me off, I might not have lost my seat of power, but the mere challenge itself disturbs my mind, isn't it? Why? Because I am attached to it. So whatever you are attached to, how do you know if you are attached to anything? What's the best way to test? When there is a threat to losing what you are attached to, or when you actually lose what you are attached to and it disturbs you, it means you are attached. Right? So the attachment by itself only creates a problem when there is a potential threat, or when we actually lose what we are attached to. So then comes the second problem that attachment brings, and that is called shoka or sorrow. So in chapter 1, this is what Arjuna goes through. Attachment to his beloved people are there, he didn't create a problem. The minute he came to the battlefield, he realized that he would be killing these very people. He would not be seeing the very people whom he loved, whom he respected and admired. That's when came the shoka or sorrow. And then he doesn't stop there. Because when shoka or sorrow overtakes our mind, what happens? What happens? When we are in the grips of sorrow, what happens? Lose your faculty to rationalize and think properly. Which leads us to the third problem that Arjuna went through, and that is called moha or delusion. Now, the intensity of the sorrow depends on what? The intensity of your attachment. The more you are attached to anything and you lose that, the greater your intensity of sorrow. The greater your intensity of sorrow means, the greater your intensity of moha. What is Arjuna's moha? What was Arjuna's delusion? First of all, let me ask you, is Arjuna's problem different than our problem now? He was attached to his parents and his family and all. Who are we attached to nowadays? So many things, isn't it? Family, spouse, relatives, neighbors, this, that, we have cars, handphones, so many things we are attached to. The more attachments you have, the more potential for shoka. And here I say attachment again, please understand, is different than love. If you lose something and you have no attachment, you have no problem. But because of the attachment, it brings shoka, and that brings moha. What was Arjuna's delusion? seeing everything lopsided. He was in such a grip of sorrow that to him the war, Arjuna was what? When he came to battlefield, Kshatriya, he was a soldier. What is the dharma of a soldier? To fight for what purpose? Not just simply go and fight, but to uphold dharma, isn't it? So now he's standing on the side of dharma, and who's standing on the side of adharma? The Kauravas. So he came very well prepared. He came to the battlefield. We are going to see in chapter 1. He comes, he even goes to convince Krishna. Hey Krishna, come and become my charioteer. He goes and convince the other kingdoms to come and support him. Do you know how many battalions were there on the Kaurava side? Huh? 11 battalions. You know how many battalions were there on the Pandava side? 7. You know what's the total of 18 battalions, amount of people who were there? 3 point something million people. That is the total size of the Mahabharat war. This 18 battalions had almost 3 over million people assembled on this battlefield. That's why it's called Mahabharat war. And do you know how many people were left after the 18 day war ended? 11 people only. Millions perished on the battlefield. Why? Because of the ego of one person, Duryodhan. He didn't want to give back the kingdom. So here Arjuna also is going through this moha. What was his moha? He came to the battlefield understanding I am fighting dharma, on the opposite side is adharma. But when he saw his people and realized he had to kill them, and Shoka overtook him, then he says what? What did he say to Krishna? Huh? He is saying fighting now is adharma. How can I kill people? It is like a policeman. He sees a robber going to rob somebody, and then he takes out his gun, he wants to shoot the robber, and he realizes the robber is his uncle. Then what does the policeman say? How can I shoot my uncle? Let him go and kill people, doesn't matter. If I kill him, that is adharma. What is the duty of a policeman to uphold dharma? He has to kill, isn't it? There may be a possibility that he has to kill. Soldier comes to battlefield to uphold dharma, he has to kill. But now Arjuna says killing is adharma. And what is dharma to Arjuna now? What is? Running away from the battlefield, he considers as dharma. So many people criticize when they say, "This Krishna, what is wrong with Arjuna? He didn't want to kill people. He wanted to go to forest, become a sannyasi. What is wrong? Is there anything wrong? Yet Krishna keeps on pushing him, go and fight, go and fight. So is Krishna like George Bush, telling people to go and fight, go and fight? So we don't understand what is the problem here. We see that Arjuna is not, he's doing something noble. He doesn't want to kill people, he's going to the forest to fight, forest to become a sannyasi. What is wrong? Uphold your dharma. That is what Bhagavad Gita is saying. If Krishna were talking to a cook in a kitchen, what will you tell him? Go and cook, isn't it? If Krishna was standing in a classroom and talking to a teacher, what will he tell? Go and teach. So if Krishna is standing on a battlefield with Arjuna, what will you tell him? Go and cook. Go and fight. Exactly. Means what? Go and fight means what? Do your duty. The problem is we are all doing our duty. But where is the problem? Duty all of us are doing. We are taking care of our aged parents, we are taking care of the spouse, we are taking care of children, we are going to work. All our duties we are doing. What is the problem? It is the attitude that has got to be changed. It is not the duty that has got to be changed. Krishna is not telling Arjuna to change his duty. What is he telling him? Change your attitude to your action. By just changing your attitude to your action, the result changes. What is that attitude to action? This is what we are going to learn in chapters 2 to 18. What is that right attitude which we should learn? Do the same action, don't change your action. In fact, when does thoughts of sannyas come to us? When you have problems in life, isn't it? Otherwise, who wants to take sannyas? Everybody wants to take sannyas when there is problems in life. So Arjuna taking sannyas was nothing wrong, but why did he want to take sannyas? To run away from his problem. So this is called misguided sannyas. Sannyas is natural progression. In fact, the four orders which we have, we start with Brahmachari as a bachelor life. Then we go on to Grihas, family life. Then we progress to Vanapras, which means when our children grow up, get married and move away, husband and wife are alone. Then we progress to the final stage, which is called Sannyas. But it is a natural progression. See, we should not take up Sannyas because we want to run away. Right? A married man cannot handle the pressures of a family life, runs away to take Sannyas. That is a problem. Right? But you must progress naturally. So, what is that attitude which we need to change? You will see first in chapter 1 what is Arjuna's problem, how it led to his despondency. First he picks up in bow and arrow in early part of chapter 1. At the end of chapter 1 he throws down his bow and arrow. And then again when Krishna gives him the knowledge how to lead his life, then at the end of chapter 18 he picks up his bow and he is ready to fight. So that is the significance of the Gita. And when we come back next week, we will see that. Any question that is there? No question means I'm taking that you understood everything. Right? Everything is clear. Okay. So we end with the prayer. Om Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kansa Chanura Mardanam Devaki Paramanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru. Thank you. Let's check it and see how.
Yeah, I'll check it and edit it.
Okay, then you let me know where you are. Yeah, we thought we're selling at 15 ringgit. When you load it, you let